This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
The moment Pamela Rasmussen saw the article, she froze in fear. Rasmussen was an ornithologist at the Smithsonian Institution. It was 1996, and she was putting together a field guide on the birds of India. She had tens of thousands of specimens and field reports from across the subcontinent to examine. It was overwhelming. Thankfully, she had a few guiding lights, ornithologists she could draw on who had done reliable work there. Without them, she would flounder, which is why the article disturbed her. It was about Richard Meinertshagen, one of those trusted sources. Before his death in 1967, he was considered the great ornithologist of his generation. He did fundamental work in India, collecting 14 species that no one else had seen there. But the article was accusing Meinertshagen of fraud. The accusation centered around red poles, brown and white finches with what looked like a smear of strawberry jelly on their chests. Meinertshagen had collected some in France once before donating them to a museum in London. At least that's what he'd claimed. According to the article, Meinertshagen had not collected the specimens. He had stolen them from another museum in England. He had then changed the labels to make it look like he had found them in France, all to prove a pet theory of his. Rasmussen did not believe the article at first, didn't want to, but the evidence it laid out was damning. She finished it with a sinking feeling. To be sure, the accusations involved only birds in England. Maybe his work in India was still sound, and Meinertshagen had a reputation as tireless, someone willing to tramp farther and search more widely than anyone else. So maybe he really had found those 14 species no one else recorded in India. But doubts were already gnawing at Rasmussen. Her career, her reputation were on the line with this field guide. She decided right then and there to get to the bottom of this. Who was Richard Meinertshagen really? And how much could she trust him?
From the Science History Institute, this is Sam Keen and the Disappearing Spoon, a topsy-turvy, sciency history podcast, where footnotes become the real story.
Richard Meinertshagen was born in 1878 into an international banking family that was second in prestige only to the Rothschilds in Europe. Meinertshagen overlapped with Winston Churchill in school, and he claimed to be descended from a king of Spain. Family members headed the Bank of England and London Stock Exchange. He loved biology from a young age. He supposedly sat on Charles Darwin's knee once, and as a teenager, he spent countless hours skinning and preparing specimens at the Natural History Museum in London. In fact, he learned the art of preparing birds from one Richard Sharp, the very man whose red poles he would later be accused of stealing and claiming as his own. Meinertshagen grew up into an imposing man, 6'5", with a booming voice and dashing mustache. He longed to become an ornithologist, but his father forced him to join a branch of the family bank in Germany at age 17. He despised the work and soon quit to join the British Army. He served in India and Burma before ending up in Kenya. At this point, Meinertshagen's biography gets a bit murky, mostly because he was a fabulist. He just made up wild tales. For instance, his memoirs and even diaries are filled with stories of atrocities he helped commit in Kenya. Burning down villages, mowing people down with rifles. He even talked of roasting a Kenyan warrior on a spit and eating him. But historians have found zero evidence that any of that happened. It's unclear why Meinertshagen invented these stories. Perhaps he simply enjoyed shocking people. In truth, he spent much of his time in Africa haughtily ignoring orders and doing science. He mapped the terrain, collected animal skins, painted wildlife, and conducted a census of animals on the Serengeti. However much of a liar, he took science seriously and did good work. Still, he was involved in two disturbing events in Africa, things that really did happen. Once, he sicked his beloved dog Baby on some baboons. He hoped that Baby would kill a few, perhaps for specimens. Instead, the baboons ganged up and tore Baby to pieces. A furious Meinertzhagen rounded up a platoon of soldiers. They hunted the baboons down and shot every last one. It was pretty ugly. Far worse was the Nandi massacre of 1905. The Nandi were a tribe in Kenya who clashed with British officials over incursions into their territory. They especially hated railroad lines and telegraph poles. They sabotaged them whenever possible. Lieutenant Meinertzhagen reached out to their leaders and proposed a meeting. He said the British wanted to work toward peace. No one quite knows what happened at the meeting. Stories differ. We do know the two sides met in a clearing. Meinertzhagen had 5 men with him. The Nandi had 24. Meinertzhagen later swore that one of the Nandi shook his hand to open the meeting, then treacherously yanked him forward to throw him off balance. It was a signal for the other Nandi to attack. Luckily, Meinertzhagen said, his men opened fire and killed the traitors. Other sources claim that Meinertzhagen was the double-crosser, that he yanked the Nandi leader during the handshake to initiate his own sneak attack. Still other sources say that the British hid a machine gun behind a rise near the meeting site and mowed the Nandi down when Meinertzhagen's men were still 50 yards away. Regardless, the outcome was the same. 24 slaughtered Nandi leaders. This decapitated the rebellion, which soon died away. Now, British colonial officials were not exactly kind fellows. They committed plenty of atrocities. But even they were horrified at whatever Meinertzhagen did. 3 separate court hearings probed his handling of the Nandi meeting. He beat all the charges, but he got shipped out of Africa in disgrace. Not that it really harmed a charmed, upper-class fellow like him. He kept his head low for a bit and worked his connections. By the start of World War I, he was back in India doing intelligence work, espionage. He later shifted to Palestine, where the British Army was fighting the Turks. During slow days on the front, he would commandeer the optical instruments that troops used to track incoming artillery. He would spend a happy afternoon calculating the velocities of birds soaring overhead. Meinertzhagen's exploits in Palestine have become legendary. Historians have written whole books about them. His primary responsibility involved running a network of Jewish spies within the Turkish army, work that won him several medals. He also met Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence described Meinertzhagen as a man, quote, so possessed by his own convictions that he was willing to harness evil to the chariot of good. Meinertzhagen, however, was less impressed with Lawrence. In fact, Lawrence once supposedly confessed to Meinertzhagen that he was a fraud. Someday, he wailed, I shall be found out. After the war, Meinertzhagen married a woman named Annie. He eventually rose to the rank of colonel and continued to lurk on the edge of British espionage. He didn't do much during World War II, beyond helping excavate soldiers at Dunkirk. But that didn't stop him from spinning wild stories about his exploits. Conveniently, if anyone challenged the veracity of his tales, he either browbeat them with his booming voice or claimed that the incident was hush-hush and that he could not say any more. One story he told involved meeting several times with Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. He was there to beg for the lives of endangered Jews, but the meeting supposedly had their comic moments. At one, Meinertzhagen said that Hitler walked up to him, snapped into a Nazi salute, and bellowed, Heil Hitler! A flustered Meinertzhagen responded by saluting back and braying, Heil Meinertzhagen! You can imagine this story getting raucous laughs at dinner after a few bottles of wine. But really, it makes no sense. Why would Hitler heil himself? More somberly, Meinertzhagen claimed he met with Hitler in 1939 with a pistol in his pocket, and that he came within a spade of shooting Hitler on the spot, his own life be damned. He would recall this tale with a sigh in later years, bemoaning how he could have spared the world the most awful war in history. His dinner guests would coo and try to cheer him up. What a noble man. You probably won't be shocked to learn that Meinertzhagen never met Hitler, much less nearly shot him. But he told such tales with enough flair and melodrama that he became a celebrity in British high society. One aristocrat was especially taken with him, Ian Fleming, the novelist who invented James Bond. In fact, Fleming based Bond in part on Meinertagen and his life, or at least Meinertagen's own version of his life. But after Meinertagen published a memoir in old age full of tales of bravado, Fleming actually quit writing. He said no spy novel could compete with the exploits of the master. In truth, after the 1920s, Meinertagen devoted most of his life to birding. That, not espionage, was his true passion. He loved to watch birds, to study birds, to track birds, and especially to steal them.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Like John James Audubon, Richard Meinertagen was both a prolific wildlife observer and a prolific wildlife killer. Over his life, Meinertagen amassed a collection of 25,000 bird skins, an obscene number. He shot at least half of them himself, and not always legally. Whenever he visited an area where collecting was banned, he carried a special walking stick with a small gun concealed inside. That way, he could shoot any choice specimens on the sly. As for the other half of his 25,000 birds, he bought the bulk of them. The rest, he stole. He stole them from museums all over the world. Paris, Leningrad, New York. But his prime target was the Natural History Museum in London. He usually showed up in the bird room there around noon, when half the staff was at lunch and there were fewer eyes to watch him. He would request a box with maybe 8 birds inside and take great pains to examine them. Then he would slip one into his coat, say cheerio, and stroll out. Given his background as a spy, he got away with it more often than not. But not always. Once, a clerk at the museum caught him with 9 birds stuffed into his briefcase. He tried lying his way out. He said that a former curator there used to let him take specimens home to study them. "Besides," he said, "I'm Richard Meinertagen. I'm a gentleman, and of course I'll return them." The museum didn't buy it and banned him from the bird room. But a wealthy friend of his, a Rothschild, got him reinstated a year later, at which point Meinertagen resumed stealing specimens. Over the decades, he got caught several more times, and the museum called in Scotland Yard twice. Both cases nearly went to trial. But the museum always dropped the charges and reinstated him. Later, Meinertzhagen even got his own key to the museum. So why did the museum tolerate him? In part because the directors belonged to the same upper-class old boys' club that he did. They protected their own. There was also the typical British terror of fuss or scandal. Better to hush things up. The main reason, though, was the 25,000 specimens that Meinertzhagen owned. The museum coveted them as a donation after he died and did not want to anger him. They figured that if he stole a few here and there, well, they would get them back eventually. And their deferential approach worked. When Meinertzhagen died, they secured the collection. What the museum didn't realize was that Meinertzhagen had not just been stealing the birds. He had been changing the tags on them, the labels tied around the birds' legs. These labels list where the bird was collected and when, the day and month. This information is vital for ornithologists. It reveals the birds' habitats and what their plumage looked like at different times of year. It also helps track migrations and determine how abundant a species is. Meinertzhagen was an expert on bird migrations, and he was changing the labels on specimens to forge evidence for his pet theories about the migrations of certain species. This is a grave scientific sin, a massive betrayal of the field. Also, imagine the hubris here, trying to make the natural world bend to your will. But to get away with this crime, Meinertzhagen had to do more than just change the labels. He also had to redo the preparations of the birds to mask the evidence of theft. To ready a bird for a museum in the 1900s, preparers followed the same basic steps. First, they sliced open the tissue paper thin skin around the belly and rolled the bird skin inside out like a sock. At this point, they discarded the guts and most of the bones. They sopped up any blood or fluid with cornmeal. Then they used a dowel and cotton balls to make a dummy mount for the bird. Finally, they stretched the skin over the dummy and sewed the bird up. Now, these were not like the birds you might see in a front-end museum display. Birds with their wings spread wide, assuming dramatic poses. Backroom museum specimens are stiff and lifeless, with the wings tucked into the side. Most don't even have eyes. They're strictly meant for ornithologists to study the features of birds. But even though all bird preparers followed the same basic steps, the details differ, because each preparer had their own style. In fact, a trained eye can tell one preparer's technique from another's at a glance, as easily as you can distinguish between two people's handwriting. This was especially true in previous centuries, when many preparers were self-taught. They also usually prepared specimens in remote places, forests or jungles or tundras, where they made do with whatever materials were on hand. Instead of using a dowel to support the dummy, some used matchsticks or bamboo. Instead of cotton, they might stuff the body with hemp or moss. Some preparers kept more bones inside than others. Some removed the brains by slicing open the thin skull, while others removed the brain through natural sinuses. Some preparers left the birds with taut, flat bellies, while others left the birds' bellies bulging, like they had just polished off Thanksgiving dinner. The stitching could vary widely as well. Meinertzhagen specimens had their own quirks. He usually turned the bird's head slightly, leaving it at an angle. He also crossed the legs and left the bodies understuffed. His birds looked like no one else's. So whenever he stole a bird from a museum, Meinertzhagen had to transform it. He would unstitch the bellies and redo everything according to his own preparation methods to hide his crimes. As a former spy and a longtime bird skinner, Meinertzhagen was pretty good about covering his tracks, but not perfect. A dogged Irish biologist soon exposed his ploy about changing the labels on red poles from France to England. And as we'll hear next week, Pamela Rasmussen at the Smithsonian would pick up that thread and soon unravel the entire tapestry of Richard Meinertzhagen's many, many scientific crimes. This is the Disappearing Spoon podcast, brought to you by the Science History Institute. Be sure to check out their in-depth science history podcast, Distillations. You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts or on their website, distillations.org.
You can find more incredible stories in my books or at samkeen.com. You can also book me as a speaker there for your school or event. If you like this podcast, please spread the word and support it at patreon.com/disappearingspoon. You can also get bonus episodes and signed books at Patreon. This episode was written by me, Sam Keen. It was produced by Mariel Carr, Rigoberto Hernandez, and Sarah Kaplan. Our sound design, scoring, and mixing is by Row Home Productions. Row Home's creative director is Alex Lewis. John Myers is Row Home's executive producer. Thanks for listening.
Row Home Productions.
I sold my car in Carvana last night.
Well, that's cool.
No, you don't understand. It went perfectly. Real offer, down to the penny. They're picking it up tomorrow. Nothing went wrong.
So, what's the problem?
That is the problem. Nothing in my life goes as smoothly. I'm waiting for the catch.
Maybe there's no catch.
That's exactly what a catch would want me to think.
Wow, you need to relax.
I need to knock on wood. Do we have wood? Is this table wood?
I think it's laminate.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's close enough.
Car selling without a catch. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.